Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Stop Child Abuse Now, SCAN radio show number 3004. SCAN is a production of NASCA, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And the mission of NASCA, I'm going to read for you. We have a single purpose at NASCA, to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional trauma, and neglect. And we do so with only two goals. One, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, CSA, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. Two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And now tonight is a Survivor Professional Night here at SCAN Radio. On some nights we have someone who is both a survivor of child abuse and a professional somehow in the field of recovering from child abuse. And tonight the special co-host will be Kim Lakin from Littleton, Colorado, a child abuse survivor and activist who's the founder of Soar on Eagle's Wings, where she teaches about prevention and intervention. Kim's an authorized instructor and certified facilitator for Darkness to Light, Stewards of Children, as well as a facilitator for the Monique Burr Foundation. She was sexually assaulted her whole childhood. Kim says, quote, "I will always be in the recovery process. I don't think that will go away. I feel that my work with facilitating has been a big part of my healing the past 4 years. I feel empowered and free when I am providing classes for the community," end quote. On these episodes, we welcome various co-hosts, survivor professionals who will assist in fielding questions and lead a variety of topics suggested by our call-in participants. Their trauma-informed perspectives as survivor professionals will help them guide discussions on the issues of child abuse, trauma, and healthy human sexuality that spring from questions and topics brought to us by our listeners. Everyone's invited to engage on tonight's show. Please visit the NASCA website, that's nasca.org. And also call us at 646-595-2111. 1-800-273-1118 and participate with this wonderful show tonight with Kim. And I will introduce Bill first and then Kim. Bill is here, the founder of NASCA, and he is here as a co-host tonight. You want to say hi, Bill?
Oh, sure. I'm delighted to, and I want to really thank you for leading the show tonight, and Kim for being our sort of playing the role of the hyphenate, the special guest and the co-host. I'm sure that Kim will do a terrific bang-up job, but this is not something that she's been doing on an ongoing basis. So it'll be a little different for all three of us, I suppose. The key is that we want to invite the listener to call in, as you said. And that's because we would like some of the topics, at least, to come from the listener, from you, the listener out there in radio world. You may hear something that Kim says, or you may have something on your mind. All of it's fair. If we're talking about child abuse, as long as it's about prevention, intervention, or, of course, recovery, we'll cover any topic that you would like to hear about or would like to make a comment about. The number to dial is 646-595-2118, 646-595-2118. And I'm delighted to be here, ladies, and thank you for sure this is going to be a great show. Thank you for being here, too.
Thank you, Bill. And Kim, would you like to say hi?
Hello, everyone. Good evening. Thanks for having me on as the professional, I guess. But I should change and update my bio because it's been 6 years now since I've been doing this. So yeah, it's exciting, and I feel very, very blessed to be able to go out and do this work.
You want to update us now on your bio? What's up? What are you up to?
Oh, it's been like 6 years instead of 4 years. I'm still doing Darkness to Light, Spirits of Children classes, and I'm still training facilitators as well to come out and do this work because we need a lot of bodies, you know, out in communities is what we're trying to get so that, you know, we can really just kind of spread the protection all around. And I like to say a lot of times in my classes, I'll say, you know, I'm creating these little niches all over town so that no matter where my grandkids go, there's going to be these people that are watching out for her. Or them, all of them now. So I just like how this whole program is set up and how it really helps adults understand how to prevent child sexual abuse. And it's something that, you know, a lot of people don't want to talk about. However, I found that a lot of young parents are interested in protection. And so they do want to know whatever tools that they can get so that they can protect their kids. Different from me. I just had to be a helicopter mom. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm thinking maybe because we talk about it more, maybe that's why the young parents are more interested in learning about it. Maybe it isn't so taboo to them the way it was when older people were growing up.
Yeah. I know when I was grown, I felt very ashamed, and I didn't want to share it with anybody because it was shameful to me. And so, you know, I had a lot of work to do throughout the years to get to this point where I can say this is what happened, and I'm able to then go out and help others. Because you do have to have, I think, a certain degree of healing has happened before you can effectively go out and help other people. And so it's been exciting to me to just see how.
I'm constantly trying to kind of evaluate from the perspective that I've gained, you know, a significant perspective, how we're doing in the world of activists who are fighting child abuse and its trauma. And, I mean, for one thing, Annie, you know, Kim's engaged in Darkness to Light, which is a terrific organization. Stewards of Children in Darkness to Light are specifically for teaching the community about prevention and intervention, but they speak to people who are already interested because they get them interested perhaps, but these are people who willingly show up for events that that are slightly structured because they have Darkness to Light people and literature and presentations and so forth all there. So that's one reason that it seems it may seem like it's easier to talk to people, because in those groups, of course, it is. They're there because they want to be there. But the question is, how are we doing with the regular public that doesn't have a special reason to be there, and how do we reach them? So we're trying to figure this out all the time and improve on our outreach. Tonight's an example where we would love to have some people call in and tell us, you know, what their experience has been and how they maybe first engaged with people, with folks who are activists in child abuse issues and so forth. But we're going to continue to do it. We want a little bit of direction if people are willing to give it to us, to see what we're doing well and what we're not doing so well. Of course, Kim is doing everything well.
No.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, I think that I have had to become, which I find myself, I found myself in these roles the last 30 years, is somewhat of a salesperson too, because you do have to get people interested sometimes. And what I found the last few years is that the preschools are very interested. I can get into a preschool pretty easily, because usually they want to give their staff something. But if you're talking to a school, like a public school, which I've done several times, I have a hard time convincing them that this is something they need to do for the school. Now, I was able to, so that's kind of the difference on, you know, how I'm getting into places. But you're right. I feel like I don't tell my story when I go in to do this curriculum, because we have this curriculum already available. It's set up a way that, you know, is made to help people understand exactly how to, you know, recognize, minimize, and, you know, react responsibly, basically. Because acting responsibly is a huge part of it as well. We've talked about this on the show before, that you know, if you don't talk to a person in a way that is helpful when they are telling you their secrets, then a lot of times, especially if it's kids, they will change their story, and so you get different stories from the child. And a lot of times it's just because they are nervous and they don't know if they're saying the right thing. And so, you know, it's important that, just like we know how to, you know, call 911 when there's an accident or our children get hurt. You know, we need to know how to address this as well. And it's huge, I think. It's just huge. And we all know that. We just have to get the people out there that have never been abused to understand how huge it is that, you know, education is important and prevention. So, yeah.
Well, I think sometimes, you know, using the statistics of child abuse with a group of people who are not knowledgeable really impresses them, because it is true that it's a big problem. And, you know, when you have 1 in 4 kids coming in contact with childhood sexual abuse, that's a huge number, you know, 25%. And that's the number. But people don't know that. They think that it's, you know, 1 in 100, you know, something like that. Well, it's 1 in 4. So if we can use statistics to our advantage to wake people up, I think that does help.
Yeah. And I think what all people are surprised about is that the 90% is somebody that they know or love, you know, or trust. And so, because you always think it's, there's still that whole stranger danger, I think, mentality out there to some degree. That, yes, you should teach your children to watch out for strangers, but you also need to be open enough with them to say if there's anybody in the family touching you in a way that's not appropriate or that you feel bad about, you know, you just don't feel good about, you need to be telling somebody. Because it could be even, well, not even just touching. We've talked a lot about in the classes about how it could be, you know, seeing a video, you know, that's child sexual abuse, just watching a video of, you know, my X-rated video. And then the 60% are acquaintances like teachers and neighbors and community leaders. So they need, you know, our kids need to know that as well, because I think we put people up on a pedestal to some degree, you know, and I know even with my kids, I was always, you know, you've got to listen to the teacher, you've got to do, you know, but I've never really asked them, okay, what if that teacher did something that was inappropriate? I didn't know how to relate that to them. And so teaching or talking to our kids at a young age about how they can watch out for themselves and have that body safety is so huge. And so that's why I think I get a lot of the preschool people. I think that, you know, the people that are interested, and it's easier to get into, you know, those than to get into a whole school district. But it doesn't mean I'm not trying. I'm out in my daughter's rural area right now trying to get into their school district. But and I've gotten into some schools. I was actually able to get into Columbine, but I didn't have a whole lot of people that came to that one. But, you know, we'll get there. I mean, all you can do is just do what you can and educate people in the way that they understand that this is possible.
Kim?
You know, recognizing the signs. Yeah, go ahead.
Kim, I was wondering if you could teach our audience some of what you teach when you go into schools about recognition and prevention.
Yeah, absolutely. Darkness to Light runs off of basically the five steps to protecting your children. So they go, you know, number one, you learn the facts. So you understand that potential grooming behaviors are out there and know what they are so that you can pay attention to it. You know, like if somebody is giving a child special attention over all of the other children in the class or whatever. And then, you know, maybe taking a child on special outings and things. I know that, especially in churches, and that's always been kind of my heart as well, is to get into churches, because there is a lot of that. There's youth groups and things like that, you know, our kids are out with the adults, and sometimes they end up one-on-one. And so, you know, learning, understanding that could happen, and then also thinking of a preventative. So for example, if there is a child that ends up in a car with a coach, let's say that was their soccer coach, and he offered to bring them home, that soccer coach could do several things to make sure that situation is safe. And one of the things they could do is get on the phone and say, hey, with even the child's parents, and say, I'm bringing your child home. I just want to stay on the phone with you until we get there. And so, you know, you're making yourself very open. Now, you know, I think there's always going to be room for somebody to mess that up and do something. But that's being aware. That this could be a situation that I don't want it to be, and I don't want to be caught in a bad place. So let's call the parents, or he could call his wife, and the student could call his parents. So that you're all on the phone at the same time as you're, you know, getting this child home. you know, isolating the child is a big reason why, you know, the just the opportunity of a child being alone with a predator, you know, just skyrockets that child's chance of being hurt because, you know, private places. So, you know, crossing physical boundaries, we talk about that a lot of times we find that predators will just, you know, do little things that don't seem like it's bad at the time. But then when you start putting things together, like, okay, this uncle always wants my child to sit on his lap. And he's very, you know, adamant about it every single time. Or, you know, I had a situation in our family where there was a new boyfriend that came into the family. And this two-year-old did not like that boyfriend. And I had to kind of put my foot down a little bit. And I said, you guys, you need to pay attention to that, because this child, this little two-year-old, is very outgoing and likes just about everybody. So there's a reason. I don't know what it is, and I'm not saying that you should, you know, accuse them of anything, but just pay attention to what's going on, because there's something different going on with that child. And then, you know, we all know that a lot of times predators will use secrecy and threats to gain control over the child. And so, you know, letting the child know that nothing's going to happen. If, you know, if you came and told me, I'm going to make sure that I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that nothing happens. So then minimizing the opportunity is the second part of the five steps. And we talked a little bit about that where, you know, not having one-on-one situations, just trying to eliminate that in any way possible. And just kind of, you know, brainstorm a little bit, because there's always going to be a situation that you could make it safer, you know, especially when it comes to kids. Have, like, multiple adults supervise. Of course, we always say that, you know, and at churches, again, I've noticed that, because the reason why I bring that up is because I was in children's ministry for 25 years with my kids. And so I saw some of the, you know, the loopholes in there of where it could be dangerous for the kids. And, you know, a lot of times there's not enough volunteers at a church. And so, you know, there is one teacher that ends up in the room with all the kids. And that just shouldn't be happening. We should be able to keep our kids safer that way. You know, and then making things observable, which we talk, you know, everybody always talks about, is, you know, if you're in a classroom, make sure that there's open windows or open doors. And then maybe if you see that something is not right, then you can, you know, just say something to the people that are in that room or to the person that has the closed door, you know, this is not right. You know, you need to keep this door open. So being aware of all of the situations that could take place and minimizing the opportunities. So at the preschools, a lot of times I'll talk to them about the playground. So I'll say, where could there possibly be, you know, little niches in the playground that kids could go hide out in? Pay attention to those, you know. Just don't leave them up to themselves. And then talk, number three is talk about appropriate behaviors and healthy touch to the kids, starting from when they're young, and reinforce that they tell, you know, a trusted adult if they feel uncomfortable or have been put in a situation that is not feeling right to them. So, you know, just appropriate healthy touches. One of the things that I say about that is they have so many books out there now on body safety and some really, really cute ones. And I started, and 6 years ago when I started this, I had a 3-year-old granddaughter, And I just had one at that time. Now I'm on almost number six in November. So, but I really wanted her to understand that, you know, her body is her body. I didn't want to have to just feel, because I couldn't be a helicopter parent anymore. I was a grandparent. So there are limits to what I can do and what I can't do as a grandparent compared to being a parent. And just preparing her in a way that empowers her was something that I was happy about. And when I started, I was really happy about it because I could do these tools, you know, give these tools. And I did actually make my children all sit down and take this class too, several years ago. So just because, you know, I wanted to be on the same page as them. Our oldest grandson is bonus grandson, and he came into the family when he was 3 years old. And, you know, it's the same 7 next month. I don't know why these kids keep getting older. It's like triple time now that I'm a grandma. We're getting so big. But, you know, I just try and talk to them in a way that, you know, they always know that I'm here for them and that I'm a safe person. And not only that, but giving kids ideas of, you know, what they can do if they're in a situation, like at a friend's house, if they're having a sleepover at a friend's house, and maybe that friend is making them feel very, very uncomfortable. And they go and tell the friend's mom that, so this is actually in a book that I'm telling you, so I'm kind of I guess quoting this a little bit or not. That kid goes to a friend. The friend is inappropriate. He doesn't feel good. He wants to go home, but the friend's mom won't let him go home because she says, you know, don't worry about it. Just go back to bed. You know, she just thinks it's a silly kid's quarrel or something, and, you know, she doesn't need to get involved. And so this kid goes into the bathroom and locks the door and sleeps in the bathtub because he didn't want to be around his friend. So I think that's a really good example. And, you know, I've read that to my kids, my grandkids as well. That's a really good example of, you know, using your brain a little bit on what you can do to keep yourself safe, because you don't have to stay in that situation. Even if you're kind of stuck in it, you can get away. And letting kids know that is powerful. It's huge for them. So we talked then, step number 4, we talked about recognizing the signs. And, you know, there can be signs, but a lot of times there's not any signs. And except for maybe emotionally. So, you know, of course, you watch out for bruising or bleeding or rashes or bumps or, you know, anything like urinary tract infections, just pay attention to, or, you know, chronic stomach pains or headaches or something like that that can't really be explained. You know, those are the things that you need to pay attention to. And emotional and then behavior signs, of course, we talked about as well. So withdrawing. Maybe it was a very outgoing kid, and then they start to withdraw and go into a depression. Maybe they're a lot more angry, and they want to be rebellious or defiant about something. Maybe they're showing sexual behaviors that aren't age-appropriate. So, you know, a kindergartner, for instance, at a school who is masturbating on the playground is not a normal thing for a kid to do. They just don't know to do that. And if they learned it somewhere, so they either learned it, you know, maybe by being abused, of course, that's the first place that goes, your mind goes to. But what if the parents just have never said anything to them, you know, because I know that that's a normal part of childhood. And, you know, I know that I had to tell my kids, you know, you can go in the privacy of your bedroom and do whatever you want, but, you know, don't be inappropriate around other people. So there, you know, you've got to kind of talk to kids a little bit too, because they're not, you know, they're not stupid, especially if they're going to start, you know, when they start to that stage of just being curious about themselves. That's a normal thing. Kids are curious. We talk a little bit about, too, that the age difference in kids, because, you know, sometimes kids will be experimenting with each other. But if there's a child that is, you know, say 7, and you catch some experiment, you know, a 10-year-old with a 7-year-old doing experimenting, that's a little bit of a red flag. They should not be more than 2 years older to be engaging in that kind of behavior. Yes, it's normal, but then again, pay attention to what's going on, and if it's just normal kid behavior. Because I know that I've had a situation also, and kind of an extended family member who that happened to. It was a child and on another child, and a lot of times that's what happens. And that's what happened with me as well. I've talked about it, that when I was 5 years old, my first sexual experience was with a neighborhood boy that was, you know, my best friend's cousin. And I knew that there were weird things going on, because at 5 years old, this I thought he was a teenager, and I knew that he liked me, but I didn't understand why, like, his pants were always unzipped, his penis was hanging out every time I came over to play with my friend at her house. You know, it was like, that's really odd, but maybe that's just, maybe he doesn't know that that's happening, or maybe he does, you know, that's just the way they are at their house. I don't know. I didn't know, and nobody had ever told me anything different. So I believe in that case that that child, that boy, was being abused, and that's why he tried to sexually advance on me many times. That wasn't the only time. But, you know, that's something that if I would have been if somebody would have told me about body safety, I could have picked up on it maybe a little bit sooner, you know, not just thought, oh, because it wasn't only him, it was his brother, too, that would have their penises hanging out of their pants when we came over to play. And it was just, I would try and look the other way and everything. And I knew that this, who I thought was a teenager, had a crush on me, because he would give me, like, these, single records that had love songs on them back in the record playing days. But it was, yeah, he would give me love songs. And so I'm like, oh, okay, that's cute. You know, that's fun. Somebody likes me. But at 5 years old, you don't understand really what it's about. I always thought that because of the advantage that he made on me one day in a closet. He got me in a closet and pulled down his pants and tried to get me to touch him. And I knew I didn't want to do that, and I didn't want to be there, but I didn't understand that it was wrong still, even at that point. So I got up and ran out of that place, or tried to, you know, run out of the house. It was in the basement, and I saw my friend, who was the cousin, being abused by another cousin, and I said this before, my little five-year-old mind just thought, I'm not mature enough to be doing this. I didn't think anything was wrong. It wasn't necessarily even wrong that her other cousin was, you know, abusing her in my little mind. It was that I'm just not mature enough. So they can have fun, but I'm leaving, you know, and didn't realize to go tell anybody. But that stuck in my brain, you know, for a long time. And, of course, I didn't want to go over there anymore. I didn't want to see him. I didn't want to have anything to do with him. So we have to understand, you know, that it could be another child. And that's what's hard to comprehend as well, because that traumatized me, you know, as much as when I was sexually abused at 12 years old and then when I was raped at 17. I mean, there were all traumas in my childhood that were traumatic, but it was just different when I was younger because I didn't understand. So we need to educate them. We need to let them know, you know, what is appropriate and what isn't. And then five, or like step number five, we talk about then acting responsible. Because like I said earlier, if you overreact in a way, especially with a child, that makes them feel uncomfortable or makes them feel like, you know, you're going to go shoot this person, you know, turn around and go shoot them. And it could be somebody that they really do care about. You know, that's going to upset them and say, no, I didn't mean that. You know, and so, you know, knowing how to act responsibly to the child and telling the child, you know, that I believe you, or even an adult, you know, if an adult comes to you, telling them, I believe you, because I would have given anything for somebody to just say that to me. Listen, you know, being able to listen calmly because you have the skills in your head of, okay, this is what I need to do after, you know, and this is how I need to respond to this person. Tell the child that, you know, that they've done nothing wrong. It was not their fault, that they're very courageous for coming and talking to you about this. We tell people don't ask any kind of leading questions about any details, because you don't want to kind of, again, contaminate their brain and make them think that they're not, you know, something's wrong with what they're saying. Because they're telling you their story. This is their story. And so you just say things like, you know, what happened? Do you want to tell me what happened next? Or, you know, something like that. And don't try and, like, fill in the gap to their story. A lot of times with kids, you just get a little bit at a time. And they won't, you know, they won't just come right out and tell you everything. They'll just tell you a little bit at a time. And so kind of being patient and not trying to fill that gap in. You know,
sometimes I was going to say, sometimes the kid is trying to figure out what he or she is supposed to do or supposed to tell, you know, how they can satisfy
right.
mommy or daddy. With by saying the right thing at certain times. So they will change their story. But children, I should say to anybody listening tonight, they don't lie. So, you know, you can trust when a child eventually does say, Uncle George, you know, has been touching me under my dress or something, whatever it is, that that's true. They don't make these things up. And can I say, Kim, you said something earlier that really touched me, because I'd never thought of it. My mother and father never talked about anything sexual at all. In fact, I didn't even know the word sex. I didn't know how babies were reproduced, nothing about that. And, of course, nothing about my own body either. But when I was being abused age 11-ish, I think it was when it started. It was the first time that anybody had ever, obviously, anybody had ever touched me. And it was a lot of it masturbation or oral masturbation by the party that was molesting me. And, boy, that was fascinating, because I was having intense feelings. Even though I hadn't matured yet, my body was on the edge of that. And it was really kind of thrilling. So when I went home, and I was there with him for a summer, like a month. When I went home after the summer was over to wait for school to begin, I experimented on myself with masturbation, and I had no idea what I was doing. I really hurt myself to some degree, because I tried so hard, you know, to get a reaction that of the type that he had been able to give me. But the thing I was impressed by what you said was, you said as a mom, you have, on occasion, you have told your children, you know, it's not dirty and so forth like that, but it is sort of, you know, semi-private. And it would be fine with you if they went in their room and did whatever they wanted. Boy, that's an amazing concept. I never even thought of it, that the parent would give permission to the child, because the child feels very guilty. and doesn't
right.
know, again, what, how much they're allowed to do and how much they're not allowed to do and what's a sin, right? In my case, it was, I might be sinning because I was so Catholic. But that was an amazing, I really liked hearing that statement. I'd never heard it before. Giving permission to the child to go in their room
yeah.
whatever they want. Yeah, that's great.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're not going to talk to them about it, somebody is going to. So they're going to hear it either
mm-hmm.
on the playground at school about sex, or they're going to hear it in a way that is explained the right way. And then when they hear it on the playground at school, they could just laugh at their friends and say, yeah, you don't have a clue. You know, they need to know. So,
very true. Yeah,
yeah,
very true.
From the time they're little. I mean, we have we have a two-year-old around here that's being potty trained, my grandson, my little grandson, and he so the big thing, I don't know if you guys have been around potty training, because I didn't do this with my kids, but I guess the big thing is to just let them run around naked all day. You know, you just stay home and let them run around the house naked, and then they run and go to the potty. And it's worked really well with all of my grandchildren. That's how my daughters have been training them. And but, you know, they've got to have a comfort with their body, and they've also got to understand, you know, that it's their body, even at that age. Even though they're running around and they have no shame, they need to, you know, they need to keep that innocence, I just think, just as long as possible. And by allowing them to be themselves, you are giving them that opportunity. So, yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of how, you know, we go about it. It's a 2.5-hour class when I go in and facilitate these classes. And a lot of it has to do with survivors who have, you know, gone through a lot of healing, and they are telling their stories on these videos. So we do like a 35-minute video that has survivors talking, and it also has professionals talking. And there's somebody on that video that talks about that, Bill, about how giving your kids permission, you know, and also not only this lady talks about giving your kids permission, but also, you know, she says that she tells her children that if I ever make you feel uncomfortable, you can tell me or you can tell your dad. Or if your dad ever makes you feel uncomfortable, you can tell me or you can tell somebody else, you know. So she even says that she puts herself in those scenarios of, you know, if I make you feel uncomfortable, because our kids don't understand that. Our kids think that, you know, they have to obey their parents no matter what. And so giving them
right.
also that permission.
That's right, yeah.
Is huge. It's good.
Well,
yeah.
And in my case, I was supposed to be able to follow the priest no matter what, or the brother, you know, the religious person, because they were representative of the church, even, you know, representing Christ, and they couldn't do any wrong. Well, they could, you know, but I didn't know that.
Right.
Because there was an absolute kind of a teaching for us children that we could, you know, that we could believe Father, right? That we could go to Father, that Father knew best and all that stuff. And that's just not true, of course. But that's how we were brought up. So it was really deeply ingrained in us. And I think we got to get away from that, too. That's another case where, you know, a person of extreme authority, like a parent, has control over the child. In some extent, law enforcement people have some of that too, because they kids are also taught to, or a lot of kids are taught to respect, you know, police officers and so forth. But more the priests, I think, that it happens, and certainly parents. So that's a really good pointer too. So thank you, Kim.
Yeah, you know, I've always, since I've been doing this work, and of course been in NASCA, I've heard of so many priests that have abused kids, and I just, it just breaks my heart, because I felt like church was my, you know, saving grace. I could get away when I went to
right.
church. And so I didn't have those experiences, and it breaks my heart. But I can also see, because I married a man who was Catholic and grew up in the Catholic churches, he is the most closed-off person I have met in my life. Well, no, next to his parents. I mean, these people, you cannot connect with them in any way. And I wonder at times if maybe my husband was abused. Of course, he wouldn't. No, no, no. And I brought it up, too. I'm like, did you ever hear about that? No, I never, you know. So he's still very, you know, proud of his upbringing and everything, which is good. I mean, maybe nothing, but there's no connection. So I've been a little bit fascinated with growing up Catholic, because I'm like, why is it that I can't connect with this man? What is it that's being taught, Bill? I'll ask you, Bill, what is it that's being taught in the Catholic churches? Is it just that your body is sinful and you're not supposed to?
Well, in some cases, yes, absolutely. Yeah. There is a, in some cases, you know, there are communities that raise their children in the Catholic Church to be kind of afraid of sexuality, you know, certainly to deny any kind of pleasure with sexuality, and they delay experimentation, as you said, with sexuality. And if you are experimenting, you're made to feel guilty about it, and very deeply guilty, because everything you do can be considered a sin, right? A sin is a serious thing. There are venial sins and mortal sins. There's two different kinds of sins. And this would be maybe a venial sin. It wouldn't be as serious as murdering someone. But still, you know, any sin you are taught as a Catholic is an affront against God. You know, it's because he expects us to be, you know, as close to perfect as we can. And the priest, of course, represents Christ. So if you go to a priest, my case, you know, I went to the wrong priest at one point. It was after I had been molested for 3 years, but I finally found a priest that I thought I could talk to, and I went and I told him the whole story. And unfortunately, you know, he was interested in me too, so that didn't work out very well. But I did it in the form of a confession, which is a Catholic sacrament, a very you know, religious ceremony. And the sacrament of confession is a way to clean your soul of whatever transgressions you've had, you know, prior to that confession. So you go in and you try to be as honest as you can with the sins that you know, you're aware of. And the priest is there to represent Christ. That's what the priest is. So when you tell all of your sins to Christ, it takes 3 hours, by the way, to do this when you're a kid. 3 hours. And then you get absolution and you get some penance. And all that, and you walk away thinking, well, thank goodness somebody finally, you know, heard me and let me talk about it, and I'm going to get some relief because they'll know. But then it turns out, like 2 weeks later, you find out that they are coming on to you too. It devastates you.
Mm.
So this is the problem that I think a lot of Catholicism has caused, this blind faith with the ministry. Not the Catholic religion, but with the individuals who run it, because it's, you know, sins come about by the transgressions of individuals, of humans, and all priests are human too. So, yeah. Does that help? Did I answer that? I think it did.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it just comes down to, especially with him, that, you know, he chooses not to connect in a way that would probably be okay with the church, because we've been married for 32 years. You know, he chooses not to, and I think something was eaten into him or something at some point.
Yeah, it's very
you will not have it. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, Annie?
Well, and then he never went to church. He never went to a Catholic church where we were married. Never. Because I even told him at one point he could take the kids. I said, you know, it would be good, because I'm not Catholic. I said it would be good if they just had an experience of, you know, different religions. And
sure.
But he never did. And neither did his mom. His mom still goes to Catholic church. But
oh, yeah.
He never did.
A lot of Catholics
so
are
he
really,
never
really devoted to it.
Yeah.
Many Catholics are extremely devoted
you know,
to their faith. Well, I
closed
I
down.
To...
I mean, it's just not you.
Yeah. No. I'm not. I don't take it personally. I don't go to church now. I don't go to Sunday Mass now and so forth. But I occasionally have an opportunity to attend some kind of function at a Catholic church. That doesn't bother me in the least. Even going to Mass doesn't bother me in the least, but I don't go all the time. As a child, I went to every opportunity that there was for a child to be in church, including being an altar boy for the 6 o'clock in the morning Mass at church, where I had to ride my bike to church at 5:30 and set it all up and everything, and then serve Mass, and then go back home and have a quick breakfast and then go to school. You know, so that was my pattern for a long time. Yeah. And we didn't miss any holiday, any sacramental days, you know, any church holidays or anything like that. And we followed all the rules, no meat on Friday, you know, all these things. My mother had to wear a hat, you know. my sister and I wore white gloves when we were very small, and she was dressed up in a little, you know, a little white dress. She kept falling in the brook wearing a little white dress, so somehow that stopped. It never failed.
So your mom was very, yeah. So your mom was very into. I mean, did your parents go to church up until they passed away? Was that kind of their life?
They went to church all the time, their whole life. And they were also active with their respective churches when they were younger. And when they married, my father, I think, was 20, maybe 24, and my mother was maybe 21, something like that. And in any case, they remained married for the next 65 years, you know. and there were times when I was sure they would have been better off had they separated and divorced and so forth, but there was no thinking about that back then. No way. That in itself is probably a sin, you know. Yeah. So, yes, we were thoroughly Catholic, through and through, soaked with Catholicism, you know, drenched in it. And that's just the way it was.
Yeah. He often think that my husband just had this thought of, you know, yeah, I went to school as a kid, but his dad never went to, his dad wasn't Catholic either. So it was just him and his siblings going to school, going to church with his mom, which is how I raised my kids too. Andy, you know, he would not go to church with us. And when I did get him there, he would just kind of make fun of it a little bit. So it was just better that he didn't go. But I also never understood like that difference, because it's so glaring in our marriage, the difference in our, you know, being raised in different churches and different religions. It seems so glaring to me. And, you know, a lot of times you hear these things of you should marry somebody who's, they say equally yoked, but whatever that means, you know, just somebody who you can really grow old with and love and connect with. And,
yeah.
And I just was, yeah, it's just, I think that he would never leave, and that's why I had to leave, is because he just never would. But, he'd be happy just continuing on pretending like everything is fine, because that's what he's always wanted. He's always been worried about what things look like to the outside. And so I'm over that. But anyway, I got off subject. I know.
That's how
it started kind of going off.
That's how these shows go. That's okay.
So,
well, the final thing I say
another
about,
thing we talked about.
Let me just interject this one final thought about Catholicism. That as strict as the Catholic Church is to its congregants, the people that belong to the church, my parents were that strict with us. My mother had had an iron fist, and there was her way and then the wrong way. That's it. There's only one choice. And if you transgress, she had no problem letting you know. And no problem, kind of lowering the boom on you. So it's very hard to grow up in a situation where there isn't at least some degree of malleability, of moldability. It's okay to go this, something, a little looseness. But when there's no looseness at all and it's completely rigid, your life is completely rigid. It's no fun, let me tell you. And that's I think, did come from Catholicism, too.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I interrupted your thought.
No, not at all. That's fine. Annie, we haven't heard from you for a little while. Do you want to say anything?
I know, because the conversation has been riveting and I didn't want to interrupt anything. I will say that I totally am nodding my head and identifying with a lot of what you said. The part about someone walking around with their pants unzippered, that was my father. He always did that. He continued to do that in my adulthood and my old age into his old age. He just continued to flash everybody. And nobody ever, my mother would laugh. My mother would laugh and say, "Oh, you zipper your pants." Yeah. And let's see. I wanted to say also that I was married to a very Catholic man who really wanted to be a religious, to go in his room and pray all the time. And so I divorced him so he could do that. But sex was not for the woman's pleasure at all. Sex was like, no, we don't even want to have sex, but if we have to have sex, it's not for you, it's only for the man. Believe it or not.
Oh, interesting. I haven't heard that before.
I have no idea.
But I haven't heard that.
Women weren't supposed to be enjoying that. That's kind of a bad thing if you were enjoying it.
Well, I guess. I've always thought that he felt bad, like he shouldn't be enjoying it or something. But, and it's possible.
Yeah.
It could be both.
It could easily be both. I don't have any idea what my parents' sexual relationship was. I saw them give each other pecks every now and then and a couple of hugs, but really almost none of that. But yet I believe they, in their own measure, loved each other, but it was nothing that got expressed very much. And there were times when there was a crisis in the marriage that I thought should break them apart, and they didn't do it. They stayed married the rest of my father's life, because that's how it was supposed to be. I think the thing about you know, comfort with your sexuality or whatever is also, you know, in my case, it was exaggerated by the fact that the priests and brothers were men. And, of course, I was a boy. And so there was a question. I didn't even know what it was back then, but at first. But there was a question about somehow it's not right for boys and men to have sex together, of course. And I didn't know what that was until I went to the, I went home after the first summer, and I learned what I did learn, I learned it on the playground. And that's a really bad place to learn your sexuality. But I heard about, you know, it was all about faggots and you know, gay guys and whatever, you know, denigrating terms they could use, and how this was, you know, really wrong. So I could not talk about it because, you know, I did not want to set myself up to be the target of their, you know, of their of slander and so forth. It wouldn't be slander. It would be of the truth that my sexual relationships early on were all met with men and boys. Well, men. And some were priests, and there was a few that were just regular men. But most of them were priests and brothers. Now, this is another whole degree of embarrassment, of shame, of responsibility, of the secret having to be kept, all of that, that you get when you're having same-sex marriage. Sex. You know? But that was then. You know, that's how it was.
Yeah. Well, and I guess, so back to Annie and what you were saying, it kind of makes me think that these boys that were walking around with their pants undone all the time, you know, like I said before, I'm pretty sure that they were being abused as well. And they probably, you know, maybe that's what the dad did, and I didn't ever see it, you know. But yeah, that's always what stood out to me, is that they just always were hanging out. Hanging out there. But,
well,
no,
I
think earlier...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm going to say the other thing that we talk about and that I provide, though, so that people are aware of what's around them is, because I go out into my community and do this. So I have, like, Child Protective Services. I have a whole list of community resources. So I've got, you know, Child Protective Services, which are in, like, five different counties. I've got on here, and any helpline that, you know, is relevant, like the National Child Abuse Hotline and the Suicide Hotline and things like that, and then, of course, some local hotlines, too. So, like, Victim Advocacy areas I've got on here, and then also resources for healing, like, you know, a Family First or the Kemp Center or something like that, medical services if that's something that they want. And then I've got then other websites about child abuse and prevention, and I've got NASCA on there as well as Darkness to Light and a few other ones that are out there. So that's I always think people are happy to be able to see that they've got these resources too, right in front of them. So this is something they put on their fridge and they can, you know, have. It's a really good preventative. One of the things that I don't think I said this time, I know I've said in the past, is that we do actually advocate to go to a victim's advocacy center if possible, if you have one within your area. just because they know how to talk to a child or, you know, or deal with what is going on. They need to see what needs to be done. And they will, in turn, relay that message, those messages over to the police or to, you know, whoever else needs to know it. And so they are put kind of at the center of the situation instead of having the child have to tell their story over and over and over again. So that's just kind of what we advocate for, is to go to an advocacy center if you can. Find what's, one that's near you and go do that. And
it's a wonderful organization, this, the Child Advocacy Center has, and you can actually find them. They have a website that's a big website. It names the ones all over the country. But, you know, frankly, I feel like at least every county ought to have one or two if it's a big county in it. And yet there are, you know, there are several hundred, but there should be many thousands. And we need to support this system because it's the best thing since sliced bread. You know, as you're saying, Kim, it's a full service, you know, center, and usually it's in the same building, all in the same building, kid friendly, you know, and decorated for their enjoyment, their pleasure, and so forth. And all the people that are in it are dedicated to gently bring the story out from the child, and they'll, you know, often they'll put it on videotape. So, and there are instances where that means the child only has to tell it on the videotape, and they don't even know they're being taped sometimes. But they don't have to go back into court maybe and tell the story over and over and over again. So you have law enforcement, you have psychologists, you have forensic psychologists, you have nurses and doctors who are specially trained to deal with children and sexual assault, you know, instances and so forth. And you have people who support the parents, because the parents are often, you know, kind of devastated too when they find out their child has been molested over time. And anyway, the Child Advocacy Centers, or CACs, are what you're looking for. And there is an organization, and it's a .org, but I don't know the name, CAC.org maybe, that lists many, many of them all over the country. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's just cool. Yeah, I just got the Colorado ones on here, so I should look that up and see what this one is.
Yeah, you
but
should.
But we've also got
the new
suicide number. What is it? 811.
Right.
Something
that's
like
not
that.
Really working yet,
yeah.
But it's a good plan. It's a plan, and it's spotty. Okay, it's supposed to be no matter where you are in the country, that you can dial 811 and get help for suicide. And by the way, this is Suicide Prevention Month, September. So it's appropriate for us to mention this a few times. But 811 instead of 911, because, yeah, it's an emergency, but it's a special emergency. It's a, you know, you will expect people who answer the 811 calls to be trained in helping with, you know, the social services that surround things like suicide prevention and so forth, and suicide hotlines and so forth. They're all, it's a great idea, and some places it works, some places it's not really set up yet or not as full as it will be. But my goodness, it's a long time coming to some of these decisions, Kim. You know, and it's pretty obvious that we have a need for a long time. But thank God we eventually get to the place where we decide to, you know, to put our money where our mouths are, you know?
Yeah, we try to start doing internet clubs along, and we've got to figure out how to keep all the predators away from our kids on the internet, you know, which is a whole other thing.
It's a whole other thing. cyber bullying and cyber sex and cyber, you know, dating and all that stuff. And, you know, a child is very susceptible because as hard as it is for us to see between the lines, read between the lines with a person we've met online, and have gotten to know over time, it's terrible for the child. They have no idea. And, of course, it's easy for the predator, usually many years older than the child, to pretend to be similar in age or close in age. And they know how to present whatever it is the child would really be attracted to, like the fact that they have a car, you know, for example. Wow!
Yeah.
And that would that could really impress a kid, you know, really impress a kid, that their friend is old enough to drive, you know. So it's all it takes. And yet the friend might be 45 years old, you know, they can't tell. It's hard.
Yeah.
Really hard.
Yeah. And just, I mean, that has been very nerve-wracking to me, is not knowing, because I'm not a grandma now and I'm not a mom, I can't be, you know, right in their business all the time. And so, you know, there's things that I see older to my 10 and 11-year-old grandchildren, because they are so much more sophisticated at the computer than I am at her age, that I can't even keep up with everything that they're doing on there. But my 10-year-old granddaughter just received a brand new touchscreen laptop so she's in fifth grade, and she's supposed to keep it through 12th grade. But she can pretty much get on anything on that app. I mean, I think they've blocked some of the, you know, really bad stuff probably, but she could get on YouTube. And
yeah.
I don't know if she can get into chat rooms or what she can, you know, but that's what that's their life now, is the computer. They're not
that's
even
right.
teaching children how to write anymore. They're always on the computer. So, which is a whole other topic too. That's frustrating.
People should not,
like, how are these children supposed to know?
Well, people should not forget that cell phones are also computers, and they give the same kind of access. So,
right.
You know, you will see, obviously, we've all seen a huge part of our population has their nose in the cell phone all the time. Kids do this all the time, right? And they're just poking around and just jumping around and here and there. You don't know what they're doing. You have no idea. But you can have access to these chat rooms and so forth and questionable websites on your mobile device. So that's another, you know, remember, the computerization is all around us, in many, many ways. And and we're never going to escape it. So, you know, it's time for us to educate ourselves. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. I didn't interrupt you.
No. I was just going to say it's time for us to educate ourselves, because, frankly, unless we educate ourselves, we won't know what to say to our kids. You know, the kids get in front of a computer, they just start punching things and they don't care where they go. And so they grow up with, you know, a fearlessness with using a computer that maybe mom and dad don't have yet, or maybe never will. Because for us, it's all trial and error, and we learn more and more, but not for the kid. The kid's never been without a computer, never. You know, so...
Yeah, I keep thinking about, you know, about a year ago, almost, it's been a year, I was out in Arkansas with my cousins, because I have a cousin fighting cancer, and they had two little babies that needed somebody to help take care of them, and so I was out there for about 3 months, and so I was staying with another cousin, my cousin's sister, and she has a son that's 15. And I just keep thinking about, there was a couple nights that this happened, that he's on his computer all by himself in his room with the door closed. You know, they're not paying attention to anything that he's doing on his computer. And then he came out and he said, oh, I'm talking to this person in a different country. And I looked at my cousin and I was like, you're letting him talk to people in different countries that he doesn't know? And she's like, oh, yeah, it's just funny. They're, you know, they're just talking. They're not, you know, I'm thinking, to myself, no, you don't know who that person is. You don't have a clue. And it happened more than once. And I just think, you know, in those instances, you got to be more aware. I mean, that person on the other side of the country could actually be just a couple blocks away, you know? And so it's scary to me. It really is scary. And my oldest grandson, who's almost 11, he has just got a phone. He just got a cell phone. And he goes back and forth to his mom's house, and his dad is my daughter's husband. And his dad and my daughter did not want him to have a cell phone. But his mom made the decision on her own when she had him. And so, you know, that situation, too, is really kind of hard to navigate for, you know, my daughter and son-in-law, because they're just being outnumbered. You know, she just does whatever she wants and doesn't really think about, you know, the circumstances around it and possible consequences either, because she just wanted him to have a phone, and that's what they decided. So, yeah.
Annie, you're leading a great show. Thank you very much.
I don't feel like I need to interject much, really. I think it's a great show. I'm learning a lot for sure. I did have another question for you, Ken. If you want to hear another question, and that is, what is soar on eagle's wings?
So that's my name, my company name, and or my ministry, or however you want to call it. And so I don't know, that name is probably not something that, well, it's not something that I really use when I go out to do my class, because I talk about darkness to light, stewards of children. But whenever I go out and speak, and this, I think Bill touched base on this when we first started the show a long time ago, is there's a huge difference. I can go out and do this education piece, and it doesn't have anything to do with my personal story. But when I go out and speak, and so I do like an hour speaking engagement instead of the two-hour class, that is my personal story. And that's a lot harder to do. It really is, because you feel mm-hmm. it within your body. And so that's just kind of where, I mean, it's just kind of my personal, I guess, website. And it's on Facebook also, Soren and Gil's Babies. And I just felt like for years and years, that name was stuck in my head. And I, you know, it's just something I feel like a name that God gave me. It was a God name. And so I go with it, you know, whenever like I said, I don't use it a whole lot, but I do have a website. And, well, actually the website is under Kim Lake and Craigor. But I have my Facebook page. I've got a Soren Eagle's Wings Facebook page, and that's where I send out all of my
Yeah, it's kimlakencraigor.com, right? That's the address. Yeah. Which, of course, if you click on the link that I have in the description, it'll take you to that, takes you to the right place. But you know what it is, Annie? It's just another tool, and it doesn't really matter which tool you use. You use the most appropriate one at the time. And, you know, if it's Facebook, great. If it's a website, great. If it's referring to somebody else's website, like a huge organization like Darkness to Light, that's fine. But whatever you can use to address the issues of prevention, intervention, and recovery, you can use NASCA. That's fine. You know, they all work. And sometimes one is a little more appropriate than the other, but, you know, it's just another tool is what it really is.
I have another question, Kim. When you go out speaking, you speak to adults, right? You don't speak to children, or do you speak to both?
So the light curriculum is set up for adults, 16 and older. So you can have teenagers. And I've had teenagers come with their parents before as well. I am a facilitator for another organization called the Monique Burr Foundation. That one, I became a facilitator right before COVID, and I haven't done anything with it. And I've tried a couple times. I've talked to some of the schools that I've been talking to see if they would be interested. And I just get so much, you know, so many roadblocks when it comes to that. So I haven't done a whole lot with that curriculum. I think it's a good curriculum, but you know, it comes down to, it is, as you know, Bill talks about on AFSCME too, it is the adult's responsibility to watch out for kids and
you know,
make sure that they're safe. And so,
and you know, Annie, we don't, as a group, as NASCA, have any programs that are directed to children directly, straight to children. And that's because, you know, if we were to do that and we had people volunteer, we're all volunteers, we'd also have to have them all take some courses and pass background checks and security checks and maybe be fingerprinted and all kinds. There's all kinds of things, which I've had done. I'm sure Kim has had some of them done. But we don't expect that of the regular NASCA membership. However, if you don't have those things, then they don't want you in front of kids. You know, that's a requirement. And so we're free to talk to any adults because they're adults. It's their choice, really. If we talk to them or not, they can walk out of the room. But as a child, you don't have that power and authority, and you are susceptible, as we said, to all kinds of influences. So generally speaking, you know, for children, you need to be sort of vetted, right, have a security check done and all of that in order to be allowed. Now, this is why many organizations, churches, and schools don't want the wrong person to address their kids. They're just afraid, and I understand. But if you can get in, that's so much the better for you. But it's a lot harder to get, you know, space in a school than it is to get a space in a church or something like that for a, you know, for an adult function like Darkness to Light. The Darkness to Light is fantastic, by the way. They come and they do these presentations by invitation. They have to be invited. They don't stick their nose into where they don't belong. So if you are interested in doing some of this work,
I do.
then you look up Darkness to Light. You look up Darkness to Light in your area, there'll be something. And they travel to you. If you put together a group of a small group of people, you know, I don't know how much it is in Kim's area, but it could be like 10 people to do a seminar with, they'll come out. They'll bring literature and sometimes displays and sometimes
Sometimes
I'll bring
food.
Wow. And they'll have to spend 2.5 to 3 hours doing the presentations. And then when they leave, it's all this printed material that they bring and they use during the presentation. But then they leave that behind. You know, they invite people to take the pamphlets and the brochures and all that stuff. So it's really great. It's a wonderful organization, and I thoroughly appreciate what they do. And if it costs you $10 to do this or $15 or whatever they're now charging, pay the $10. It's worth it, let me tell you.
And it's worth 2 continued credits as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it something you can do online to become an activist with Darkness to Light? Can you do that online, or do you have to go in person?
Everything is online now. It all got transferred over during the pandemic, so we used to not be able to. But you can go on to it's D2L, the letter D, the number 2, and then the letter L.org, And you can actually take the two-hour class online by yourself. And that way, if you wanted to stop and start, you could do that. So you can go ahead and do that. You can also, it is a $10 charge when you go online. However, I'm going to share this on the radio. I hope they don't mind. But Allie Rasmussen is a part of Darkness to Light as well. She's the gymnast that spoke up against the doctor. And she goes out and she does a lot of fundraising throughout the year. So if you are interested and you really want to do this, get in touch with me and I will give you her code and you will be able to just take it for free. So it won't cost anything. But $10 really is worth it. Like I said, you get the 2 continuing education credit hours, which usually that will cost you, you know, upwards of $100 a lot of times if you want to get any continuing education hours. And then if you want to become a facilitator so that you can go out and do this work like I do, then there are online facilitator classes as well. So that's an 8-hour class. It's still worth continuing education credit hours. You get 7 for that all-day class. And if you are interested in something like that, you do need to take the 2-hour class first so you kind of have an idea of what it's all about. And then there are always classes going on to become a facilitator. And I'm going to have one as well after the conference because I'm going to do Darkness to Light in Texas at the Hope PICS conference in October. So I will be doing a class there, and then when I come back, I will be doing an online facilitator class on November 4th. So if that's something, you know, anybody is interested in, you can look that up on Darkness to Light as well. Just right on their website, you can look up to become a facilitator, and you will find my name or other names of other instructors that are doing this. So, yeah. I answer your question.
I'm going to do this. I'm definitely going to take the 2-hour class and get started with that. I know I'll learn a lot.
Oh, I think so too. I can't say enough about it. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say we're also in the process of getting a new curriculum. So online, if you take it online, it's just a little bit different than what I go out and teach right now, but it's all the same information. It's just we're changing the structures a little bit and things like that. So I actually just did the online one again because you're supposed to. I don't know why. I mean, I don't know how many times I do this throughout the years, but I had to go online and do it again to keep my facilitator, you know, thing up. So I just took the online one, and I really like it. I really like the way that it's structured online, too. So, yeah. And if anybody ever has any questions, I'm available. I have my information on NASCA.org, and you feel free to contact me if you ever have any questions.
I'm sorry, Kim?
I just said thanks for having me.
Oh, well, thank you so much. You've been great. I've learned a lot. The little voice says we have 90 seconds left, and so I'll just remind our listeners that this is Stop Child Abuse Now, SCAN radio show number 3044. And this show, as all our shows are, will be archived on the website. The website is NASCA.org. That is NASCA.org. And NASCA is a 501c3 organization self-supporting through its own contributions. And if you go to the website, NASCA.org, you'll find a lot of resources to help you with recovery and prevention and all of those good things, intervention. All right, and that's about all the time we have, so I'd like to say good night. This is Annie Marges, and thank you for listening.
Night, Annie. Thank you, and thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you, Kim.
You're going to play the music? You need me to play it. I'll do it if you want.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was gone. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.